Today, DFA, looking back and looking forwards. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and property news. Well, we made it to the 1st of January 2025. Happy New Year to all of those watching. And greetings, of course, to our followers and supporters. We really appreciate it. Today, what I'm going to do is to take you through some of the top shows from last year and also talk a little bit about some of the main issues that surfaced and share some of my thoughts about what we're going to be doing in 2025. And the way to get into this, I think, is to look at the DFA analytics on YouTube, because it's actually quite a powerful set of tools that they provide, which gives us quite a lot of information about which shows worked and which shows didn't, and how we did compared to last year. And here is the overall channel summary for 2024. And so you can firstly see that views were 2.7 million, up 6% from the previous year. So that's great news. More people watched our shows. And in fact, through the year, we started doing shorts. Now, those are videos in a vertical format and under 3 minutes. And interestingly, as a result of that, while the views were up, the watch time, the hours, dropped. Actually, it was 29% lower than the previous year when I didn't do the vertical videos. Now, we did manage to gain another set of subscribers. We've actually went up by 4.2 thousand subscribers, and we're actually just under the 70,000 mark. And just a reminder, if you haven't subscribed already to DFA, please do so. It really helps us. And we are aspiring to get to 70,000 and even up towards the 100,000. Growth is, you know, painful. It takes quite a lot of work to be able to get those subscribers to stick around. But I really appreciate all those who have subscribed. And if you haven't done so yet, please remember to do so. I've also not disclosed the actual amount of revenue that I generated. It wasn't massive, but I will highlight that it was less, 19% less than the previous year. That's directly connected to the number of watch hours, and that's directly connected to the shorts. So I think my first learning point for 2025 is go easy on the shorts and focus on the longer form videos. Now, of course, we offer a mix of recorded shows, one every day at least, and also live shows around once a week. And interestingly, we don't get so many viewers on the live shows, but we do have a loyal following. And I want to say thank you for those who loyally come in week by week on the live shows. We've really built a great community, and I very much enjoy the banter and the conversation in the community, as well as, of course, the support we get directly. And just to underscore that, Leighton Somerville just recently said, for those who don't watch all the time, Damien Klassen, this was Damien on yesterday, Damien isn't just saying his opinion behind everything he says, is an insane amount of research. The last couple of weeks, Martin, you've been smashing out the good content. Really enjoyed it. Wishing you all the best for 2025. Well, thank you. And yeah, it is very important to understand that we are pushing content based on analysis and deep thought, not just one of those ranty, ravey channels. And Damien is a great example of that. He's really thoughtful in what he does. And for those who missed the show yesterday, it's still up. And he went through the market performance in 2024 and spoke about 2025. So that's great. And Leighton, thank you for your comment. Another comment from JetPlane10, one of our great followers. Congratulations on a great year of shows. Highly enjoyable. Happy New Year. Happy New Year to you, JetPlane, as well. And once again, nice to see some great returning people who are very loyal and provide great comments through the year. Now, one of the things I want to highlight is that we are very focused on financial education and information. And in fact, Leonie made the point that back in 1972, complained to the high school vice principal there was nothing in the curriculum on financial management. It's a bit better now. So grandsons do have economics at high school, but not adequate. financial literacy is not common. And that's one of the things that I want to highlight. We're trying to raise people's awareness of financial issues so they can make better financial decisions. And frankly, if you wanted to understand the core reason for DFA's existence and helping people to make better decisions for their future. As I often say, if you make a bad financial decision, it isn't just a point in time decision, but it echoes on. It's what's called a punctiliar action. In other words, it's a point in time, but it has consequences downstream. And so, for example, when you buy a house or you make investment decisions, if you make bad decisions, then quite often that really hurts later. So financial education is one of the things that we're trying to do on this channel. And we're using our analytics and our own understanding of the way financial systems work. And that hopefully comes together quite well with our guests to be able to plant some interesting ideas, concepts, and very importantly, to raise people's financial resilience as a result. Now, another byproduct, of course, is showing the studio up, because, of course, there is quite a lot here that we do with regard to the studio. This is, of course, the way the studio is set up. It's pretty stable now, and I do use this studio every day to make shows. I do enjoy the technical side of the work as well. And the point I'd make, I think, is that the studio is a means to an end. So I regard the technology as interesting, quite exciting actually, but it's not an end in itself. Now, if you're interested in more information about the way the studio works, well, I might make another show on that. Just put a comment below. Quite a lot of complexity, of course. I have switches and I have cameras and I have streamers and I have recorders and all those other things and lighting and a microphone and, you know, a few other things in the background there to make it all work. But as I say, the studio has been relatively stable this year. And of course, we do so have the studio hands. The doggies are there. And thanks to my PTZ camera, I can zoom in and out and make sure that they are actually in the frame. The dogs, of course, are there pretty much every day when I make recordings. Occasionally we hear from them, but quite often they are quite quiet. Right, now what I want to do is to give you the top 10 shows through 2024. Now what I mean by that is those with the largest number of views in the last 12 months. And as we will see, some of these are shows from this year, but others were shows from an earlier time. And in fact, if you watch some of the earlier shows, you can see how the studio has morphed over the last few years. So the first show I want to talk about is in 10th position, and it was called Smashed. It was published on the September the 4th this year, and it highlighted the slowing GDP in Australia and the consequences for households. Well, now we know Australia's annual GDP growth rate fell to its lowest level since December 1991. That's outside of the pandemic, of course, as consumers hunkered down in the face of elevated borrowing costs and stubbornly sticky inflation. Australia's annual GDP growth rate has slowed markedly from a decade average of around 2.4%, partially, of course, due to the RBA's rate tightening campaign through 2022 and 2023, targeting inflation. Cash rate is currently at a 12-year high of 4.35%, and policymakers have signalled they're in no rush to cut it anytime soon. This weak growth is the cost of getting inflation under control, said Alex Joyner, the chief economist at IFM Investors. With the RBA's policy setting likely to remain unchanged through the remainder of the year, the risk is second half growth disappoints expectations of a modest recovery, he said. Governor Michelle Bullock, of course, last month said that it was premature to think about easing, and her deputy Andrew Hawser last week reinforced that view, saying that inflation is still a bit stickier in Australia than in countries like the US. The RBA reckons that the June quarter will be the low point of the slowdown, predicting the annual expansion will accelerate to 1.7% by the end of the year, before peaking up to 2.5% in late 2025. I guess we'll see about that. Anyway, Australia's second quarter GDP was worse than economists had expected, growing by only 0.2% over the quarter, to be up only 1% year over year. The result missed analysts' expectations of a 0.3% quarterly rise. With Australia's population still growing aggressively through net overseas migration, the population increased by 0.6% in the second quarter, meaning that per capita GDP declined by another 0.4%. In fact, Australia's per capita GDP has now declined for 6 consecutive quarters and 7 of the past 8 quarters to be down 2% from its peak. As you know, if you've been following my surveys, the household sector is hurting especially, as higher household earnings were partially offset by an increase in income tax payable and mortgage payments. And so despite the population surge, household spending actually fell 0.2% in the second quarter. And that's dropping 0.1 percentage points from GDP growth. Discretionary consumption was hit particularly hard. This puts a number on the political pain of falling living standards from the inflationary cost of living squeeze made worse for mortgage borrowers by those RBA higher interest rates. Now, in ninth position was a show from 2020. This is actually one of our most popular shows ever, and it was Down the Rabbit Hole Part 1 with my friend George. And interestingly, we find that that show still attracts a lot of information. Now, this was quite a philosophical show because I was talking here about the frame of reference. In other words, how do we think about things? What assumptions do we make? And are those assumptions true? This is a very important underpinning of the way I think about the world. And so being able to explore the frame of reference and to challenge it is quite interesting. Something very different this evening. I want to introduce you to my friend George. Now, George is somebody who's actually been quite helpful to me with regard to the technical side of the studio. He's actually ex-ABC. But as we've had bunches of conversations over quite a long period of time, he and I have actually gone down a number of rabbit holes. And I thought what we would perhaps do is reprise some of those discussions tonight. George, hello, good to see you.
Hello, Martin. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. And like I say, we spend a fair amount of time down rabbit holes, don't we?
We do. It was fascinating how I came to meet you because both you and John Adams really caught my attention. And I remember calling you up and talking to you about what I thought of central banking around the world. But for today, I thought rather than actually talk about central banking and problems that we're facing economically in Australia and around the world, I thought to start off, we would talk about clear thinking and how we come to kind of believe what we see in the media, what we're taught at school, etc. And so I came to the conclusion that if we can actually get across to the viewers the idea of questioning what is told to them, they need to be able to answer truthfully to themselves whether or not something that's told to them can be proven factually.
Right. So it's what I think you're getting at, and this is something, I'm a philosopher, right? By training through university, I actually am a philosopher and actually very nearly went into academic research after completing my degrees. But the fundamental point here is what's called the frame of reference, right? Everybody carries around in their heads a little model as the way that the world actually works, right? It's basically you absorb it from your parents, you absorb it from the experiences that you have, all the things that you consume, be it media or everything else. But there is an implicit model. And most people never stop to think about what that model is and how it actually functions and how it determines the way you see things, right? And so one of the things that philosophy does is to try to strip away that and highlight some of the assumptions that people actually have. And once you start doing that in the financial sector or elsewhere, you reach some quite amazing and quite interesting conclusions. But I think your point would be, yeah, that's precisely it. And even when you're a kid, you start getting indoctrinated.
So thanks to George for contributions to that show. And he's actually been on more recently on other Rabbit Hole episodes. Just search the channel to get hold of those. Now, the next show, which was published on June the 30th of this year, was entitled More Household Trouble in the Land of Oz. And that related to our surveys. We publish our surveys regularly, of course, and we have been tracking the pressure on households over the last 12 months. Well, we've got to the end of June, and I've just run my updates relating to mortgage stress and rental stress and overall financial stress for households in Australia. And the news is not great. For those of you who've not seen the show before, let me just remind you that we take data from our household servers, which are running all the time, 52,000 there at any one time. And we update our models at the end of each month to enable us to estimate what's happening with regard to household finances. We can slice the data multiple ways, think of it as a Rubik's Cube, and we can also begin to take a view as to where prices, for example, may go in the future based on our scenarios. You'll see our scenarios are not future forecasts, they are sensitivity estimates. But if we take our mortgage stress data, the price trajectory information, the buying and selling intentions from our surveys, the migration data, and the broader economic information, put it through our core market model, run it through our scenarios, we can then take an estimate of what may be happening at a postcode level, right up to a region, state, or indeed an all-Australia level. So it's a pretty powerful way of tracking what's going on. And by the way, if you're interested in a conversation about a particular suburb, we can do that via our one-to-one service. This is a confidential individual discussion with me. It's not financial advice, but I can look at my data and look at the underlying trends, and I can look at stress, house price data, and also think about where the sensitivities may be pointing ahead based on our modelling. You can book a time for a conversation via Zoom or indeed by phone, typically up to an hour. And there is a cost involved because there's quite a lot of work to do to put this together. If you are interested, you can contact me by my blog and send me a message there. Or you can actually go to the blog. I'll put the link in the comments below and you can see specifically the one-to-one offer that's there. I'm booking about 3 to 5 weeks ahead at the moment because I'm quite busy with lots of people trying to work out what's going on with regard to the property market. So as I go on, let me just remind you again that I have a very specific definition of stress. There are many different definitions of stress out there, from 30% of income or maybe taxable income, through to those who apply some sort of underwriting metrics. But we define stress in cash flow terms, money in, money out. So if you have more outgoings, excluding one-off discretionary items, than income, we define households as stressed. So if they've got a mortgage, they're mortgage stressed. If renting, they've got rental stress. We can also do the same for investors with cash flow pressures. And if they have cash flow pressures on their investment property, we can spot that. Or indeed, if they're trying to dispose of their investment property, we can capture that too. And we can aggregate the data to look at the total financial stress down to the postcode level. We can talk about a percentage of households and a count. Generally, I think that the count is a better measure simply because it's the rule of big numbers. Now, just going back to the definition of stress, the RBA put this little chart up some time ago, which I find quite an interesting way of highlighting the transition from mild budgetary pressures through to more severe pressures, through to missing payments and ultimately insolvency. I want to stress that what I'm doing is measuring the financial flow pressures at the mild end of the spectrum. So it's an early indication of potentially more trouble ahead. And that's, I think, important because it does lay the foundation then to understanding that budget pressures ultimately can transition to missing payments and even insolvency, but that journey can take a few years. One reason why we're seeing significantly higher levels of stress at the moment in Western Australia, despite recent bubbliness over in the West. So to the end of June 2024, you can see here that the overall trend for rental stress continues to deteriorate. We've now got 77.3% of those in the rental sector having cash flow pressures on their rents. This is a disaster for many households, and unfortunately, it is very widespread across the country. We've seen a very consistent rise And of course, it's accelerated recently in the last 2 or 3 years, not least because the average rental increase for many people has exceeded 20%, and new rents in particular are still rising. Mortgage stress is still wobbling around the 50 to 51%, and that's essentially saying half of households with a mortgage have cash flow pressures. Also means, of course, that half of households are doing fine still. But again, comparing it to February 2020, when 32.9% of households had difficulty, the proportion has climbed dramatically thanks to the bigger mortgages and also the higher interest rates that people are now paying. And of course, the expectation is higher for longer. So we would expect the yellow line to continue to rise higher, although the cost of living support and the other government interventions through the budget, which are going to come in from 1 July, may in the short term suppress some of the stress, at least for a little while. Now, in seventh position was a show called 7 Days to Stop 1984. This was published on September the 24th, 2024, and was a collaboration between Robbie Barwick from the Citizens Party, John Adams from In the Interest of the People, that's our other channel, of course, as well as publishing it on the Walk the World channel, DFA. And here we were talking about the Misinformation Disinformation Bill Part 1. Of course, that bill ultimately was chucked out. Hi, folks.
Hello, Martin. How are you today?
Yeah, pretty good. Very important show, this. It's actually going out on both Walk the World and In the Interest of the People, because we have a very short period of time to deal with something which is really critical.
The reason why we've come today with Robbie is to talk about this totalitarian piece of legislation that the Albanese government is trying to ram through the parliament about so-called misinformation and in terms of disinformation. And the reason why this is important is that the government is attempting to suspend free speech in the alternative media, which is you and I, and including Robbie. And over the last 6 years, Martin, as we've been doing shows on the economy, on the cash ban, on bail-in, on ASIC, on white-collar crime, we have been promoting a whole set of information, facts, narratives, which is completely contrary to the mainstream media. And so the ruling elite in this country do not like when independent voices go on platforms like YouTube or X or Facebook, etc., and actually promote a completely different message to the Australian people. And so this issue of misinformation, disinformation, it's not a Australia phenomena. Only in the last fortnight, we saw senior officials of the European Union say that the top policy priority in Europe is to combat misinformation, disinformation. Now, Martin, I will say, in fairness, there are personalities, there are organised efforts, even by some governments, both in the West but also in the East, to trick people into believing something that is not true. I mean, there is nefarious players trying to confuse people, particularly in the lead up to elections. So that sort of activity is happening, and I think it's fair to say that we should call that out. And I don't think we should welcome that sort of organized campaign in Australia. But the risk of this legislation, if it gets into the wrong hands, and we've got Robbie here to explain the ins and outs of the legislation, it can do serious harm to silencing people like you and I, where we have pushed the establishment on so many areas. And just to go on the cash ban, we were called conspiracy theorists for more than 9 months by Aaron Patrick of the Financial Review, who just said that our arguments about the reason why the cash ban was completely illegitimate from a public policy point of view, he just said we were completely nuts. And we were correct all along, and our arguments prevailed, and we were able to stop Australians going to jail for using cash. And so the cash ban is one of those examples where the alternative media is so critical. You know, before we hand it over to you and Robbie Martin, dare I say, I think ASIC would say that a lot of my analysis, a lot of these shows that we've done on in the Interest of the People about ASIC and their lackluster performance, they would call our content misinformation and in terms of disinformation. And so we cannot have the minister, a bunch of bureaucrats, controlling what citizens say and what they communicate, particularly when we want to criticize the economy, the government, the banking system, the financial markets. We need to be free to have open and robust debate. And that's why this legislation has to stop. And the reason why we've called this show 7 Days to Stop 1984 is this piece of legislation has gone to a Senate inquiry. The government only wants 7 days to allow for submissions. So we are recording here on Monday, the 23rd of September. So in 7 days' time, so Monday next week on the 30th of September, that's when submissions are supposedly in. And so for something that is so fundamental to human rights and in the course of freedom and political discourse, to only allow the Australian people 7 days to raise their opposition, it's clear to me, Martin, that the fix is in. Labor wants this to go through. Labor is being directed by the Biden administration, the United States, and the European Union in Europe to push this draconian piece of legislation through. And they don't want the Australian people to rise up against this law. So we're doing this show to warn the public, and we'll get Robbie to provide some instructions as to how people can get engaged in the next 7 days to stop Albanese with this piece of legislation, and so that we can continue to be free in this country.
Now, of course, that bill was ultimately thrown out twice, but they did sneak in the social media bill for those under 16. So by the back door with the digital ID stuff, but we still have the government essentially trying to control what we see and think. Now, in sixth place was a show from the 14th of February 2024 titled The Rat Leaving Sydney's Sinking Ship. And here we spoke about the fact that people are having to leave Sydney because prices for property are way too expensive. Well, Sydney is at risk of becoming the city with no grandchildren, a senior government official has warned, as high housing costs drive young families to leave. The state capital is losing twice as many people aged 30 to 40 as it gains, according to a paper by the New South Wales Productivity Commission. If we don't act, we could become a city with no grandchildren, the agency commissioner Peter Andrisks said. The Productivity Commission found that Sydney lost about 35,000 people aged 30 to 40 between 2016 and 2021. The exodus of that group is a problem, according to the report, because people in that age range are among the most productive in the workforce. They've generally completed their training and they've had 10 or more years experience, and the majority are tech savvy, the report said. If these productive workers leave Sydney, then it means the rest of us who stay here are going to have to work a little bit harder to produce the same level of goods and services. The Productivity Commission blames Sydney's high housing prices on a lack of supply. In fact, in the past two papers, the Commission made the case for boosting higher density closer to the city in areas where people want to live and where infrastructure costs less. But in its latest report, it found that a quarter of residential zoned land within 10 kilometres of the CBD is subject to heritage protection, restricting redevelopment. Entire suburbs have been declared heritage conservation areas by some councils. In fifth position was a show from December the 8th, 2024, The Cash Con and the News Gods. And here we spoke about the fact that cash is still very much in vogue, despite what people may be saying. And in fact, some of the media are still pushing an old story, when in fact, the truth is, more people are actually using cash. Today, we look at the latest on the war on cash, ask why banks are behaving so badly, and what the real story is. The bottom line is this: cash remains a critical element in the economy, its usage is growing, not shrinking, and you're being fed a line by the banks and by the media. Once upon a time, a bank used to take money from people with cash to spare, depositors, and lent it to people who needed the loan, borrowers, allowing the bank to take a turn or margin on the difference between the interest paid to depositors and interest charged to borrowers. Interest is essentially the price of money. In addition, they will provide a range of branches for people to interact with the bank, to provide a range of services, including access to cash and taking in cash deposits, including from businesses. A critical part of this was the management of cash, including its transportation and storage. It was just a cost of doing business, and all was well with the world. It's not commonly known, by the way, that depositors, when they place money on deposit, are in law unsecured creditors of the bank, something to bear in mind amid the fears of deposit bail-in, which was snuck in under international direction a few years, just be converted to equity in a failing bank to keep it afloat. But then marketeers got the reins of the banks and stepped up the cross-selling of more products and services to direct customers. Often, they would embed hidden fees and charges, such as, for example, insurance on credit cards, sometimes automatically added to the product. They reduced loan buffers and pushed larger mortgage loans on people who were eager to ride the property wave at any cost. Banks became more reliant on mortgage lending for their profitability, as shareholders became more demanding on bankers to perform for them. Merchant bankers got to assist the banks with financial engineering, where they started to securitize or sell off their loans to investors. Remember the tie-up between Aussie Home Loan founder John Simons and Macquarie? And these same merchant bankers also encouraged the banks to make market bets on the trajectory of the financial markets. In the US, the division between speculative banking and core retail banking, known as Glass-Steagall, which was a vital protection for depositors, was thrown out. Merchant bankers and retail bankers merged into a single risk-laden entity. Management accountants taught them to unbundle all of the costs of revenue elements in their business to avoid cross-subsidization and to make it easier to embed more fees on customer-facing products and services. Their trick, by the way, was to load up costs using activity costing to services that they wanted to make unprofitable. The whole process is actually less scientific than presented, but gives banks carte blanche to justify charges equivalent to, well, wounded bulls. It's a con. Ask me how I know. And technology has enabled digital services to become viable for the banks as an alternative to branch transactions and even cash itself, to the point where bankers have declared a war on horrible, expensive to handle cash, leading to closed branches, ripped out ATMs, and people being led by the nose into a digital future which hangs by a technological thread which is cut when the power goes off. Last year, I was instrumental in getting the Senate inquiry into regional banking off the ground, and the hearings across the country brought into sharp focus the dire consequences of branch closures for people, especially in regional areas. The report recommended that cash be safeguarded in the community and offered some solutions to achieve this. Now, it's been quite quiet on this front until recently. Last month, Treasurer Jim Chalmers said Australia will mandate businesses selling essential items such as groceries and fuel to accept cash payments, joining countries from Spain to Denmark amid the growth in more preferable digital payment methods. He said that while around 1.5 million Australians still use cash for more than 80% of their in-person payments, the number of businesses accepting them has shrunk. The changes were designed to ensure that people weren't left behind, he said, while outlining the government's plan. We're making sure that people can pay cash for essentials if they want to, and if they need to, Chalmers said at a press conference in Canberra. Cash can be a really important lifeline. Now, in fourth position was a show from March the 19th, 2024, titled Digital Tyranny, Another Step Closer, as Digital ID Bill is passed. And this, of course, was from May the 19th, 2024, when the Digital ID Bill was pushed through. Well, this past week, as everybody was focusing on the budget, our controlled digital future came one step nearer as the Australian Federal Government's Digital ID Bill sailed through Parliament last week with the support of the crossbench, having been previously passed in the Senate.
Second reading. A bill for an act to provide for the accreditation of entities in relation to digital IDs and to establish the Australian Government Digital ID System and for related purposes.
Is leave granted for the third reading to be moved immediately? Call the member for Braddon.
Leave is granted, Speaker. Leave is granted.
Give the call to the Assistant Treasurer and Minister for Financial Services.
Thanks, Speaker. I move that this bill be now read a third time.
I'll put the question. Those opinions say aye. Against no. I think the ayes have it. And I call the clerk.
Third reading. The bill for an act to provide for the accreditation of entities in relation to digital IDs and to establish the Australian Government Digital ID System and for related purposes.
I have to report that the Digital ID Transitional and Consequential Provisions Bill 2023 has been fully considered by the Federation Chamber and has been agreed to without amendment. I present a certified copy of the bill. The question is that the bill be agreed to. I'll put the question. Those opinions say aye. Against no. I think the ayes have it. Those have it. Division required? No division required. This bill has been agreed to. Give a call to the Assistant Treasurer and Minister for Financial Services.
Thanks, Speaker. I ask the Leave of the House to move the third reading immediately.
Is leave granted? The member for Braddon. Leave is granted. I give the call to the Minister.
I move that this bill be read a third time.
I'll put the question. Those opinions say aye. Against no. I think the ayes have it.
Shadow Minister for Government Services and the Digital Economy, Paul Fletcher, on Wednesday said that while amendments in the Senate had improved the bill, there was still, quote, considerable uncertainty about how the scheme will work. And he said that with private digital identity providers like the Connect ID system already gaining traction, there was a risk that the digital identity landscape could become fragmented, which makes the scheme a poorer cousin of private sector solutions. Actually, the passing into law of this bill may, at a superficial level, sound sensible, given that as more Australians are increasingly transacting online, our identities are indeed vulnerable in new ways. So, the government says that the digital ID is to provide secure access to other services that we can have confidence and trust in. And despite all of the political assurances about, well, it won't ever be mandatory, well, I've got doubts about that. In this digital infrastructure, more and more control, less and less ability to get around it and not use it. That's a problem. Now, in third place, from October the 13th, 2024, was a show called The Falls in Home Prices Are Accelerating, What Next? And there we looked at the analysis and we spoke specifically about what was going on with property prices and where falls were beginning to take off now. And we're seeing that trend, of course, continuing. Well, last Tuesday, my live show about the latest from our surveys, we walked through our scenarios for property prices over the next 3 years by each state. I'm going to recap that segment from the show. But before I do, here is a screen grab from Sydney auctioneer Tom Pannis, who says the Sydney real estate market is in a price fall. It's a great time to buy in the next few months. Well, it's certainly looking like a buyer's market, but I'm not sure I would rush in now. Even Albo switched from an auction to private treaty for the sale of his investment property in Dulwich Hill. As Tom Pannis put it, they are not going to get crazy bidding on the day. And realestate.com published an article on the 12th of October with a title, $75,000 down in 3 months. The inner city hotspots in free fall. The article refers to Brisbane. In second place, from March the 31st, 2024, was a show called The Fight for Cash Just Got Terminally Serious. And once again, this is about the use of cash and the fact that the banks are trying to get people not to use cash, whereas in fact, ordinary people are using cash more. And of course, there was a particular campaign at that stage for cash to be used. Very interesting trend, of course. And as I discussed earlier, this is continuing to be a significant factor as we head into 2025. And in fact, the government later in the year announced that they would ensure that cash was available for certain types of transactions. Well, despite cash being legal tender in Australia, surprisingly, it is legal for businesses to refuse to accept it, provided they inform consumers of their stance before, quote, any contract for the supply of goods or services is entered into. And in fact, the war on cash has taken an interesting turn, with the RBA being questioned by the Senate inquiry into regional bank branch closures and claiming the use of cash has fallen, but frankly, on thin and filtered evidence. While Armaguard, Australia's only cash-in-transit business, is facing the prospect of collapsing due to the claimed declined use of cash. The RBA, which regulates the payments industry and is responsible for printing money, is also involved in current crisis talks. and a social media campaign led by the Cash is King Facebook group is calling on Aussies to withdraw and use cash next Tuesday, April the 2nd, in protest against the shift to digital payments. The protest is aimed at showing Australian banks and retailers that there is indeed still demand for the use of cash in society. That is, if you can still find an ATM. And the show that hit first place, with more than 121,000 views so far and still rising, was from December the 6th, 2024, and it was titled Australia is Stuffed. And well, this is where John Kehoe from the AFR really laid in to bad policy over 20 years. And it really summed up quite nicely some of the things that I'd been saying over the last few years with regard to bad policy, with regard to migration, bad policy relating to productivity, and a bunch of other things too. High government spending, of course, low productivity is a result. So this was a really important show. And once again, it highlights the fact that individuals are under significant pressure thanks to bad government policy. Well, just occasionally you see an article that says, yep, this is really important stuff, and John Kehoe from the AFR has written such an article. He writes, the stagnant private sector economy and deterioration in living standards exposed in national accounts this week has been years in the making. Labour productivity has failed to improve since 2016. Business investment is languishing close to 1990 recession levels, and there's been no serious economic reform. Undisciplined government spending is in vogue after too much stimulus during the pandemic, and the Reserve Bank of Australia has been forced to push up interest rates to grind household and business activity to a halt to bring inflation under control. As a result of all this, economic growth slowed to just 0.8% through the year to September. And in per-person terms, the economy has been shrinking for almost 2 years after adjusting for population growth. It is the most prolonged downturn since the 1991 recession. A better measure of living standards, disposable income per person is 10.5% below its peak. So there you have it. Those were the top 10 shows for this last 12 months. And if you think about it, it's all connected, really. Bad government policy, trying perhaps to quieten down a lot of criticism of their policies, particularly via social media. A lot of households under pressure because the RBA is holding interest rates higher for longer, simply because of the fact that government spending is very high, and that's inflationary. And as these pressure on households continue, then don't be too surprised if you start to see house prices begin to ease back a little despite high migration. And of course, the government has done very little to really pull migration lower despite the lip service. Now, the point I'd like to make is, interestingly, the shows that did best were predominantly those that I made on my own. That said, of course, we had the show with George and the show with John Adams and Robbie Barwick in the top 10. But I'm interested to see that my live shows, and indeed those with guests, don't do as well, which may tell me something about what I should be focusing on in 2025. Again, be interested to get your comments, and we'll be fascinated to see whether you'd like to see more guests or less guests, more analysis, less analysis. I'm going to continue to do what I do, which is to look at the data and to try and bring home some of the key truths in that data, and to highlight some of the key trends underlying it. So I want to say thank you very much indeed for all your support through 2024, and I hope that you will continue to follow the channel through 2025. If you haven't subscribed, please do so. If you haven't liked the shows, please like them. It really does help. And I'd like to say thank you very much to all those who've supported our activity through the Super Chats and other financial contributions via Patreon through the year. If you'd like to support me via Patreon, very welcome to do that. We really have a great support on that channel, and links are below there too. And I'd also particularly like to call out Cookie Boy for throwing a number of very important press clippings through to me each week, which form a basis for a number of the shows that we run. So Cookie Boy, thanks. Call out to you for all your support in particular. And more broadly, to all of those people who have supported the channel over this year. So I'm going to keep going, still going to produce daily videos, hopefully, every day of the year. And we'll see how far we can get in the next 12 months. with a target, of course, of 100,000 subscribers eventually, but immediately 70,000, which hopefully will be in the first quarter of this year. So thanks once again for following us, supporting us, subscribing to us, and I want to wish you all the best for 2025. Let's hope it'll be a peaceful and more prosperous year. But there are, of course, some shadows on the horizon, which will at least keep us busy through the year. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.